This is Richard A. Lupoff. My guest today was born in Monmouth Memorial Hospital, Long Branch, New Jersey, on January 31st, 1923. His name at birth was Nahum Melech Mailer, later anglicized to Norman Kingsley Mailer. Norman Mailer was raised in Brooklyn, New York. He attended Harvard University from 1939 to 1943, majoring in aeronautical engineering. He served in the United States Army, participating in the campaign to liberate the Philippines and in Japan during the post-war occupation. Following his discharge from the Army, Mr. Mailer and his wife lived for several years in Paris. It was during this period that Mr. Mailer's first published novel, The Naked and the Dead, made its appearance. Norman Mailer has written more than 30 books, including both contemporary and historical novels, journalism, social commentary, and criticism. He has also written, directed, and performed in some 15 motion pictures, and even written the lyrics of a song for the 1987 feature, Tough Guys Don't Dance. Mr. Mailer's newest book is a huge collection, well over 1,000 pages, of works selected from throughout his career. Since this book, The Time of Our Time, serves as a retrospective of a long and very distinguished career, today's conversation will, I hope, do the same. Let's start, if we may, with this question. When did you know that you were going to be a writer, and how did you know?
I think in my freshman year at Harvard, I went there with the idea that I wanted to become an aeronautical engineer. I'd actually gotten into MIT, but what I noticed, I grew up in Brooklyn, was when I mentioned MIT to the girls, they didn't react at all. And when I said that I'd also been accepted by Harvard, they go, "Harvard?" And then they'd look at me with dewy eyes. And I thought, well, there's no question, I'm going to go to Harvard. Because Harvard was not much on aeronautical engineering. And in my freshman year, I started writing, and it just took everything over. I found, finally, there was something I was good at. You know how kids are. They're always looking for something they're good at. They're not that great a baseball player, football player, this, that. And they just want to star in something. And I never had. And now suddenly, writing just seemed exciting and natural and lively to me. And I kept writing. I must have written, I think I probably wrote 20 short stories my freshman year at Harvard.
When you attended Harvard, there were three major student publications, The Crimson, The Lampoon, and The Advocate. What was The Advocate, and what did you do there?
The Advocate was a literary magazine, and we were the poorest of the three. We always had money troubles, and on top of that, we were the least well-regarded. The Crimson was creating future journalists of a high level. Ben Bradley, for instance, was in my class, and I'm sure he was on the Crimson. I never asked him, don't know him that well, but I'm sure he was on the Crimson, and from there went on to have this huge career as a newspaper editor. So that was the powerhouse, but you had to give yourself to the Crimson. It was like playing football. You know, you spent, in the competition, kids must have spent 12 hours a day working for the Crimson. How they did anything else, I don't know. And the Lampoon was very clubby and marvelous. They had a marvelous little building. And we were in the stern of the Lampoon, literally, because the Lampoon was a sort of pie-shaped building. And then there we were at the back of it, sort of breathing the exhaust of the Lampoon. The Advocate was also had a charming floor, the top of an old wooden building, fourth floor, and it had a wonderful smell of beer and Coca-Cola in the carpet, plus a few old drinks, just a faint odor of puke, because we'd have some hideous drinking parties where kids would be thrown up all over during the initiations, stuff like that. They'd sort of scrub the puke out, and you were left with the beer and Coca-Cola, which came with the site.
But what did you, Norman Mailer, do for The Advocate?
Well, I wrote a few stories for them, and I think I became some sort of editor in my last year, or my junior year, because whether you're a senior year, you generally moved out for the new people who were coming in. And then what happened is I wrote a story. I got on in my sophomore year, and the story I wrote that they published, I think, at the end of my sophomore year, ended up winning Story Magazine's national contest. So that made my way very easy, because my family, who were a little concerned that I no longer want to be an engineer but a writer, were absolutely, they lost all doubt. They were now convinced, yes, he's going to become a writer. And so unlike most young writers who, in those days, whose parents would oppose their becoming a writer and say, please get a job, do this, do that, they were all for it. So they didn't argue with the idea. Norman's going to be a writer was their attitude. That was a huge piece of luck, and having parents that were that receptive to the idea.
You worked briefly at a state hospital in Massachusetts.
I worked there, yeah.
And I understand you wrote a play about this experience, originally called The Naked and the Dead. Is that true?
Yes.
What became of the play, and what became of the title?
The play, nothing ever became of it. At one point, I think the Harvard Dramat was thinking a little bit about doing it, but not too seriously. And the title, however, had a much more successful career.
Yes.
What happened is when I handed in the first 200 pages of my war novel to Little Brown, because it went to Little Brown before it went to Reinhardt, somebody asked me, what's the title? And I hadn't given it a title yet. And I said, oh, and I thought of that old title. I said, oh, Call It the Naked and the Dead.
Well, while The Naked and the Dead was your first published novel, it was far from your first published work, and it was not the first novel you ever wrote.
No, I'd written two before.
Mm-hmm. What were those early works?
Well, the first one was called No Percentage, and I wrote it when I was about, I don't think I was 18 when I wrote it. And it wasn't very good. It was really pretty awful, the sort of book that an 18-year-old would write who didn't know too much yet about writing at all. And the next one was a very long book. I worked in that mental hospital for a week, no more. I couldn't take it more than a week. It was a true hellhole, because in those days, the patients were all, they didn't have all the sedatives they have now, where now if you work in a mental hospital, a lot of it you can feel as if you're working on a living death ward, a morgue where bodies are walking around. But in those days, they used to just beat the patients up. It was
really
truly a hellhole. You know, patient get out of line. And the first advice I was given is when there's a fight between two patients, wait till one wins, and then we both jump the winner.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so it was ugly because they really, you had guys working there for 60 hours a week for 19 bucks a week and room and board. And so, they weren't the highest cut of workers. There were some pretty brutal guys there. And anyway, at the end of a week, I just wanted to quit. I'd seen too much brutality, and I had a feeling if I hang around long enough, I'll get to be just like these guys.
Yeah.
I discovered there's a certain pleasure in beating people up. So that ate at me, and then I said I want to be transferred to another ward. And he put me in the old folks ward. The old folks ward, and these old folks would look at you with angelic looks on their faces. You thought that they were looking at you as if you were their savior, and what you discovered was, no, they were crapping in their pants.
Oh.
And they had this sweet look that had probably been the first bowel movement they'd had in 2 days.
What was the name of the book you wrote about this experience?
Well, that book was called A Transit to Narcissus.
Yes.
And, I worked there for a week, and I worked on that book for 9 months.
And what became of it?
It eventually got published many years later by a gentleman named Howard Ferdig, who has a small press. And he published it in manuscript. In other words, what you have are the manuscript-type pages. Sold it for about $100 a copy, that sort of thing. And I don't even know if he ever sold them all out. There maybe is still a few around. And it got reviewed in the Times and stuff like that.
I came across a few other titles here. Left Shoe on Right Foot.
Yeah.
A Calculus of Heaven. The Greatest Thing in the World.
Well, The Greatest Thing in the World was a story that won the Story Magazine contest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Calculus of Heaven was just a... that was a short novel, and was published in, trying to remember the name of the book, Crossfire or something like that. Not Crossfire. I can't remember the collection. Edwin Seaver used to put out this collection and of new writers. He was one of the first to put out collections of new writers. And so Arthur Miller was in that collection. I'm trying to think of who else. Quite a few well-known writers. So that is what had been published before I sat down to write The Naked and the Dead.
You and Miller lived in the same apartment house at one time, didn't you?
We did. We did indeed.
Were you buddies? Did you talk about writing?
A little bit. Actually, he helped me on the contract for The Naked and the Dead. What I think about that's funny, looking back on it now, is we sometimes meet. It was a brownstone. There were only four families living in the house. And we often meet down on that long table where they lay the mail in the brownstone entry. And we chat a little. And I always thought, he was rather ordinary, and he always thought, I'm sure, the same of me. I think we each walked away thinking, gee, that guy never amounted to much. And that was the year that All My Sons was produced, and the following year came Death of a Salesman.
Yeah.
So that we're both totally wrong about in our prognosis of the other's career.
Are you still in contact at all?
Hardly. He doesn't like me much because I... did an interview with him, which is like so many of those interviews go. It was very pleasant while we were doing the interview. But when it came to the writing, I got much more severe. You know, I've noticed that over and over and over again. Journalists, I'll have a marvelous time with a journalist, we'll have a very good interview, and then I read it. And I say, what the hell happened? This isn't what we were... But, you start thinking about it.
But you can't falsify the quotations.
No, no, no. He was a very good interview, and the quotes were good. I didn't falsify them at all. But I started thinking about his relation to Marilyn Monroe, and my basic take on it was he never understood her. And he kept writing piously about her and how wonderfully sweet and lovely she was. And all the while she was going crazy with these inner lividities. You know, she was getting more and more hateful because what she needed, God knows what she needed at that point. You know, I think if, let's say if I had been with her, which I always found her very attractive, she'd have wrecked me. I mean, yeah. Miller's pretty strong. She didn't destroy him. She just paralyzed a good many nerves in him before it was all over.
You did a book about her, did you not?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, years later I did a book, and I think he never forgave me for what I wrote about him in that book, because I didn't see him as this all-conquering God. Miller's as vain as they come.
There was a whole generation of American novelists who emerged from military service in World War II, and war experience permeates their early works. There was Irwin Shaw with The Young Lions, James Jones from Here to Eternity, Kurt Vonnegut, who's forever writing about the bombing of Dresden, it recurs over and over in his works. Joseph Heller, of course, with Catch-22, and Gore Vidal, who's kind of problematical in a number of ways.
When he wrote Willowaw.
Yes. Question, then, is the connection between war and literature. Actually, of course, it goes much farther back, whether you look at the Red Badge of Courage, or you look at the Iliad, for that matter.
Or for that matter, you look at the writing after World War I, when Hemingway and Dos Passos and Faulkner all reacted to World War I and wrote about it. But, I think what happens with a war generation is that it's a watershed. And those who went through the experience together have something in common with their readers that you don't have in a situation, in a contemporary situation. You know, we came out of the war. Our readers had been in the war. And so when we wrote books about the war, there was an immediate contact, and you could mark the period. You know, we were a generation of post-war writers, and we all had that link.
And now that it's been 53 years since that war ended, do these works have validity and they have contemporary value?
I think you'd have to go through them one by one. Catch-22 certainly has validity, From Here to Eternity, The Naked and the Dead, they all have validity. There were a lot of minor works that I don't know that they lasted. There were dubious works like Guard of Honor by James Gould Cousins, which received wonderful reviews at the time. No one seems to talk about it anymore.
That seems to be Cousins' fate. I mean, By Love Possessed was the novel of the century for about 3 weeks.
Yeah, and then Dwight MacDonald destroyed it, you remember? He wrote for The New Yorker and took it apart piece by piece. It was a complete work of demolition, as only Dwight MacDonald could do it when he got angry.
I understand that you were an acquaintance of Willie Gaddis. Is that correct?
I know Willie slightly. We're not close because our careers have been so different.
Yes.
That I think from Willie's point of view, I've had a cushy life compared to his. He wrote I've never read The Recognitions, but I understand some fabulous novel.
Masterpiece.
And he never received the recognition he deserved for it. That can embitter a man profoundly.
Critics have suggested that you were influenced by many writers, most notably, I thought, Tolstoy and James T. Farrell.
Mm-hmm.
Who else do you feel may have contributed to your own growth as a writer, and whom would you recommend to young men or women who wish to pursue a career in literature today?
Well, for me, I can answer the first part of the question.
Please,
yes. Which is, my influences were direct. It was Tolstoy. To a lesser degree, Dostoevsky, there was Thomas Wolfe, there was James T. Farrell, to a smaller extent, Hemingway and Steinbeck. I'm talking about For the Naked and the Dead. But I'd read all the contemporary American novelists of that period. The thing is that there was a rich sense of the American novel then. Now, I wouldn't know who to... Now the trouble is you almost feel like a specialist. An author comes to you, has a certain style. Who do you recommend? Well, you have to know a lot about. Do you recommend DeLillo? Do you recommend John Irving? Do you recommend Updike? Do you recommend Roth? So forth. Do you recommend me? You'd have to know. In those days, it was different. You just read them all.
Yes.
And you learned from all of them. And it was a simpler world in a way. You could read them all and somehow incorporate all of it into your own work one way or another.
Well, would that not still be a good idea?
Don't know, because I'm not sure. My guess is maybe not. Maybe you, because in a way, we've all gone very far apart from one another in our preoccupations. And I'm just not sure. Let's let it go. I really don't have an answer.
I'd like you, if you would, to talk a bit about your own working methods. Do you start, I mean, this sounds like nuts and bolts stuff, but I'm sure that our listeners will be interested, and I'm interested, as to whether you start with a character, a theme, or an event, or an image. Do you outline, or does it all just come out of the brain?
Well, each book was different.
Yes.
And in The Lake of the Dead, I was very careful. I had index cards on every character. I had the equivalent of actors called the backstory, which is that I just kept going in more and more and more for things I wouldn't put into the book. I knew an awful lot about each character before I began to write about them. I almost created them with a card index. I never did that again, oddly enough. Done other things. But basically, if I have a method, it would probably be that I can't really do a book until I find the characters. And my books are never plot-driven. I'm not that good at plot. I arrive at plot through having characters have things happen between them. But I'm never happy trying to figure out a plot, because if I figure out the plot too soon, then my characters get locked into the plot and they don't develop. My idea of having some modicum of fun while writing a novel is that my characters surprise me and they take turns I didn't expect, and I have to keep up with the characters. Whereas with a plot, you're just trying to figure out how to make the character plausible so they can go through the gears of the plot. So that's my method. I've said over and over that when you write a novel, you can't write a novel by an act of will. You can, but it's not going to be a good novel. That you have to really wait until you get the idea, and that each time it's like falling in love. You know, I can do a book of nonfiction, put the purse on the table, tell me the topic, and if I'm interested, I'll do it. I always feel more like a professional prize fighter when I take on a piece of nonfiction. One in the sense that the way they say is, all right, I'll do this fight. The money's good enough. I'll do the fight. Yes. Whereas with a novel, it's never that way. As I say, it's like falling in love. It just doesn't happen. You can't say, I want to start a novel on Thursday.
Is it fun to write a novel?
To write?
To write a novel?
I wouldn't call it fun. It's more like having a deep relationship with someone who's very difficult.
And what happens when you come to the end of it?
Well, the two good times for me in writing a novel are when I'm thinking about it, in the weeks and months or years before I start a novel. And I'm thinking about it. That's a marvelous time relative to the writing, which is drudgery and hard work and worry and concern. And then when you finish, there's one moment when the whole book comes over you. Well, at least when you finish a first draft, you feel you've essentially got the book, or whichever draft it takes. But at a certain moment, you feel, I've got the book generally. The rest is just cleanup and details. And that's a very good feeling. So a novel starts with a very good feeling and ends with a very good feeling. And in between, it's just an awful lot of dull, heavy, straight, slogging through mud. I mean, I'm always happy I was in the infantry in a certain sense. Cavalry, but they took away our horses, so we were infantry. Because that gave me a sense of going on patrol and dragging through mud for 12 miles in a given day. Gave me a good preparation for writing a novel.
How much do you revise?
Now with the word processor, I never use a word processor. I just write longhand. I'm well enough off now to afford a good assistant. And she'll type it up for me, what I write, and fax it back to me, because I now work up in Massachusetts and she's still in New York. And then I'll edit it and send it back to her. In the old days, because you had to have some regard for the typist, I might revise something twice. Now I can revise it 6, 8, 10 times if it comes to it. So I tend to probably write, my first drafts probably tend to be a little less good than they used to be years ago, but I think the finished product is at least equal because I go over it so carefully so many times.
You have been, or had strong political feelings all your life. Even at Harvard.
Yes.
For instance, you...
Not at Harvard, really.
Not at Harvard.
Sentiments, but not well, active. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't active politically.
Is the legend true about your smuggling money from France into Franco Spain?
Yes. Actually, we didn't smuggle money. We smuggled leaflets in with a group. I don't recall smuggling any money in, but if we did, it was a small amount.
Yes.
So small, I don't even remember, $100, a couple hundred dollars. No, we smuggled in leaflets. But what I did was much smaller than what my sister did some months later. Because originally I was going to go down there with my first wife and we were going to take out a few escaped prisoners from a Spanish jail. That was the original. But they couldn't arrange the escape while we were down there. So we came back and then a couple months later they were able to do it. They figured out a way to have the prisoners escape. And my sister went down with a writer you may know, Barbara Pope Solomon.
I know the name, but I don't know her work.
Anyway, the two of them went down there. My sister's named Barbara, too. And the two Barbers picked up, with the aid of an intermediary, a Spanish kid named Paco Goitia Bosia, I think. Goitia Garcia was his name. Picked up these two prisoners. Paco accompanied them to a given place where it was greedy take off. And then the two girls drove these guys up within a mile of the border where they climbed over some hills and escaped from Spain.
Into France.
Into France.
This was about 48.
48 is the year we're talking about just now.
Were you involved in politics in France?
No, not at all. Not at all. I hardly knew what was going on.
But I understand that you did support Henry Wallace, who was running for president in the U.S.
I came back to America to support him. I was only in Paris for a year, not 3 years. But we came back to America to support Henry Wallace. And I worked in his campaign in 48.
Did you feel that there was a real chance of his victory, or was this
No, we had hopes. Exotic. We wanted him to get – we were hoping he would get so many million votes. In other words, I think anything over 3 million would have been very good. We knew that was the limit of it. Actually, he only ended up getting a million, and that sort of wrecked the third party.
You won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize 20 years later, 1968, for The Armies of the Night. Thus, an author who first won fame as a novelist was honored as a journalist. You won the Pulitzer again in 1980 for The Executioner's Song, another work of journalism. Would you discuss the relationship between Norman Mailer journalist and Norman Mailer novelist?
Well, wait a minute. To begin with, The Executioner's Song is a novel.
It was a novel.
I mean, I call it a novel, and I think a writer's got a right to name their own child.
Fair enough. I'm glad that you clarify that.
There was a tremendous amount of journalistic work went into it.
Yes.
But you know, if I had changed the names in that book, The Executioner's Song, instead of calling him Gary Gilmore, if I called him Harry Kilmore and changed everyone else's name, it would have become what they call a key novel.
Yes.
In other words, if you know the key, you can tell who the real people were. But it's a novel. It was written in the form of a novel. It reads like a novel. The fact that it actually happened, in my mind, is not what decides that it's nonfiction. Because for me, all forms of nonfiction, most particularly history, are essentially novels. They're just novels that have more facts in them than the average novel. In other words, a novel, if you have 100 elements of fact in a given narrative, a novel might have 4 facts. Where a piece of history might have 8 or 10. But we have to recognize that the vast majority of facts in any given situation are not even known to the author. These are all works of the imagination. History is a work of the imagination, which is more key to fact than the novel. But it still is fiction as far as I'm concerned.
So there's no line between the two?
There's a line and that there's more adherence to fact and to certain canons of the writing industry involved. In other words, if you're writing history, you have to obey a few concerns that you don't have to obey if you're a novelist. But I think the difference is much more exaggerated than the reality. The reality is that they're pretty close. They certainly are family. They're first cousins, novel writing and history. They are not separate creatures at all.
Mr. Mailer, please forgive me for jumping around like this, but you were a founder of the Village Voice newspaper in 1955. What were your intentions? And after 40-plus years, what do you see as the state of journalism today and its direction?
One of my closest friends, Dan Wolfe, who later ended up being an advisor to Mayor Koch many, many years later, was, I think he was about 40 years old at the time, and he wanted to start a paper. And his idea was, at that time in Greenwich Village, there was The Villager was the only paper. And that was sort of a classy shopper, and that's about all it was. And so he wanted to start something called The Village Gazette. And he brought in a friend named Ed Fancher, and we each put up, I think, $15,000, the three of us. Later brought in another fellow named Howard Bennett, who also put in $15,000. The Voice, essentially, in its first year, ran on $60,000. I gave it the name. At a certain point, I said, the Village Gazette, let's call it the Village Voice. And that stuck, and the name was kept. I didn't work on the paper during that whole hideous, difficult, hard period of getting it launched. I came in after the paper had been out for about 8 or 10 or 12 weeks. I started doing a column, which created a great deal of rage, indignation. It was a very insulting column. I had certain ideas about you got to wake up your audience. So I insulted my readers. You know, I said, I don't know if it's worthwhile writing for a bunch of people who are lazy and disappointed and envious and disagreeable as all of you. It was sort of in that tone. And, of course, it created a storm. And people said, get rid of this pest, this narcissistic pest mailer. It was like that. And it was a tremendous tempest in our little village teapot.
But they come back and buy the paper next week.
Yes, they came back, and it worked. But then finally what happened is I began to have run-ins with people who were working on the paper because they kept having typos that were driving me crazy. And so finally I got into a war with them, and I quit. let me say parenthetically, I was smoking marijuana like a fiend every week. So if there's ever been a time in my life when I was remotely close to Hunter Thompson, it was in those in those years. And so I just quit. Finally, I quit the paper in high dudgeon. And the moment I quit, the paper began to find its legs, because what we'd had is a huge disagreement on policy. I wanted the paper to be revolutionary, radical, crazy, pushing forward. Dan wanted it to be staid and conservative and just a little bit to the left of the Villager. And we couldn't get along. We were just fighting every day over where the paper should go. The moment I quit, what happened is I realized is that a void was left. And the void that was left was that there was really a potentiality for a leftist paper in New York, in the Village at that time. And Fancher and Wolf, once they didn't have to be combating me every day, sensed that void and moved into it. And a lot of writers began to write for the Voice, who were very talented. Jules Pfeiffer came along with his extraordinary cartoons.
Yes.
And a year later, the Voice actually broke even and began to be successful. And 5 years later, it was a money cow for the people who'd invested in it. The only investment in my life I ever made that returned a huge profit was the Village Voice.
And a few years later, a group of very radical people came along and started the East Village Other, as I recall it.
Yes, I think Howard Bennett started it.
That was Howard.
He was disaffected, and he left the Voice. He also left the Voice.
Well, let's stay on this subject for a moment longer, and I'll reiterate the second part of my question, which is the state of journalism today and the direction of journalism today.
Well, it's an awfully large question for me to even tackle, but in many ways, journalism is a lot better than it used to be. However, it's much more accurate, more responsible. It's more this, it's more that. But there's something, there's a fundamental built-in structural weakness in journalism, which is the stories have to be written too quickly. And there's also a nastiness at the heart of journalism, which is if you don't get the story right, it's almost to your advantage. Because, let's say, if you've done damage to someone, provided it isn't legal damage, and you misinterpreted them in the story, they come back with more news and more information the next day, and you can keep a story going that way. So there isn't really a high motivation to get all the facts straight on your first version of the story. Just get the story out, and it'll become an actor in the process. So that's one of the things that happens. Another is that the limited space tends to reduce everyone to stereotypes. And newspapers like stereotypes. So in that sense, in many ways, journalism is not at all, can never be wholly successful. But I'm a novelist, so I'm not going to like journalism. I don't think it's fair for me to give an appraisal of journalism.
Well, the younger Norman Mailer was famous as a man of passion and of excesses, a womanizer, a drunkard, on occasion a man of violence. Do you feel that this was a fair appraisal?
Yeah, on balance, probably it was fair in that I've smoked a lot of pot, drinking a lot, getting into a lot of stuff one way or another, and finally it erupted. I'm not going to talk about it particularly, but I did stab my second wife, Adele. That changed everything. It was my children have had to pay for it more than I have. And
But she recovered.
Oh, yeah. Otherwise, I'd be a lifer, wouldn't I? I'm close to it. So so those were sort of explosive years. And
now what year are we talking about, or years?
Well, we're talking about from about 54 through to about 61, and then it continued through the 60s, but at a less intense pace, because what happened is the war in Vietnam began to heat up about 65, and then all sorts of things began to pop loose, but by now there were political movements. So a lot of the anger and the suppressed violence one felt could go into these political movements. And one did become active in them. There was a march on the Pentagon. And that was extraordinary. You speak of it as a work of journalism, but actually it was something else altogether, which is I found a peculiar, curious form that I really received from Henry Adams. He used to write about himself in the third person. And he talked about his experiences in Washington, say, Adams felt this, Adams felt that.
Yes.
I remember I read the book when I was a freshman at Harvard and didn't understand it. I figured what an odd way to write. But when it came time to write about the March on the Pentagon, I used Mailer. Norman Mailer became the central character. And it was delightful to do that. It was a great, not exactly a liberation, but there was a fluidity, a facility to writing that way. It was very agreeable because I found that when you make yourself a character that way and talk about yourself in the third person, your love of irony can play around it. So here is Mailer. I keep talking about, you know, this peculiar hero we have, Mailer. We can't really call him a hero. He's more a protagonist. You know, there he is. He's good at this. He's terrible at that. And I was able to sort of stay in judgment upon myself. And it was a huge psychic cleansing at the same time that my style got better than it had ever been before. So that book, I wouldn't exactly call it journalism. It has no word you can apply to it. It wasn't a memoir because it only takes place over 4 days. It certainly wasn't journalism because I didn't interview anyone for it. I just recalled and remembered my experiences. What can you call it? It was an account. It was, in terms of my writing, it was as well written as anything I've ever done. So let's say it was a very well written account of 4 days in the March on the Pentagon.
Would this relate in any way to Capote's book, In Cold Blood?
No. Later, there was a lot of discussion, mainly by Capote, about how I lifted his techniques and methods for the Executioner song. But in fact, Capote lifted it from Lillian Ross, who used to use this, what Capote called nonfiction fiction. Oh, I forget what he called
nonfiction
it.
Novel. I always thought that was a very peculiar
very
phrase.
Heavy way to do it. Yeah. I wasn't any better. I called the Executioner song a true life story, which was corny, and I wish I hadn't called it that. Finally, now they call it things like factive and dreadful words, awful stuff. But finally, there is that in between where you write about real people as if they're in a novel. And which is what began to give me this idea that finally the difference between fiction and nonfiction is much smaller than people realize. But in any event, Lillian Ross wrote about John Huston's making of the movie Crane's book.
Red Badge of Courage.
Red Badge of Courage.
Which itself was a piece of war fiction, a classic piece of war fiction.
Yes, but Huston made a movie of it, and Lillian Ross covered it in detail. It appeared in the New Yorker issue after issue way back in the early 50s. And it was a marvelous piece of writing, and that was the beginning of this method, you see, that Capote claimed he discovered for himself and claimed I'd stolen from him, which was absurd. You know, the method was there to use. I didn't need Capote to show me the way.
You ran for mayor of New York.
Yeah.
You and Jimmy Breslin were associated.
He was running for president of the city council. In a primary.
Democratic primary,
yeah.
Question arises again as to whether this was a lark or what my anarchist friends sometimes call an attentat, or was it a serious bid for office?
Oh, we were serious. You know, we were scared. We were serious. We were working. I was working harder than I ever worked in my life. The idea of running in fun used to just appall me. Breslin, who, you know, played every game a journalist can play for years, now suddenly was on the other side of it, and he was saying, these guys are no damn good. You know, suddenly you realize what journalists do to other people. he used to have one joke, which was whenever something good happened and our fortunes prospered, he'd turn to me and he'd say, we're in trouble. We're in real trouble. Because the idea was if you got elected in those years, you got shot. Don't forget this was 69, right after Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. The idea of, well, if we ever won and we're running New York, how long would we last? So he used to have this little joke, we're in trouble, we're in real trouble. Every time we saw a hopeful sign in our campaign.
Norman Mailer, you have been engaged in some famous and monumental feuds in your career. If you would discuss at least briefly your relationship with folks like, I'll put them together here, which I'm sure would upset them, William Buckley, the late James Jones, and Gore Vidal.
Mm. Well, they're totally different feuds. And the one with Jones was not a deep feud. I mean, we never spent a lot of time attacking one another or anything like that. It was just we weren't much friends at the end, which I regret.
Yeah.
I did love From Here to Eternity. I thought it was a great book.
He died young, and rather tragically young.
He died relatively young. I don't think he was, well, I don't know. I think he was in his 60s when he died.
Was he?
And Gore Vidal and I had a big one that went on for years, but we finally made it up when I was president of Penn because I thought I'm supposed to be bringing writers together, not having feuds. So I put out a few feelers, and he sent a few back, and we ended up burying the hatchet in shallow soil.
Well, you were both rather on the left, at least.
Yes. Well, that was another one of the reasons I thought we shouldn't fight.
And both very talented novelists.
Yeah, well, I think Gore is more talented as an essayist than as a novelist. But he may not agree. I don't know.
What about Buckley? Interesting character.
We never had a feud as such. We had a debate at Medina Temple in Chicago that I always claimed I won. To this day, I think I won. I think Buckley wouldn't admit it, but that's because he's not about to go around saying I ever lost anything. And since then, we just oh, once in a while we have some sniper fire back and forth, and we kind of grin and shove each other a little when we meet at a party, but there's nothing really there.
There's not real ill will, serious
no,
ill will.
No, I don't have any. In fact, his son, Christopher Buckley, is a hell of a good guy, and I like him.
Of all your works, these 30 books plus films and other works, which pleased you the most?
You know, for years I would never answer that question. I said, I have 9 children. I'm not going to tell you which one's my favorite, because 3 days from now I could change my mind. And so I've been that way about my books, but I think probably I've got to start naming them. Because the one that I think is my best book is one that very few people have read relative to the others, and that's Ancient Evenings. And there's generally a feeling that's dismissive about it, about, oh, well, there was that huge book he wrote about Egypt that isn't very good. Well, they're wrong. It's my best book. It's my deepest book. It's my hardest to read. It's very structured. It's got a lot of literary handiwork in it, put it that way. And it's not a comfortable book to read, but I think that I have more to say on that book than anything else I've ever read or written.
Well,
not
why,
ever read, but never written.
Why transpose your narrative setting thousands of years then?
I wanted to withdraw from America for a while because I've been doing nothing but write about America. It was the 80s when I wrote that book, 70s and the 80s. America was hell-bent toward wealth at that point. The revolution was over. It was a country I hardly understood any longer because all the wrong guys from my point of view were winning. They're still winning. I mean, I felt out of it. I felt like a defeated almost a guerrilla army now, for the last part of a guerrilla army for the last 20 years. And this guerrilla army that I belong to, we all fight in this guerrilla army more than we ever fight the opposition. Don't know how to fight the opposition. So in a certain sense, I just wanted to withdraw from America for a while and try to understand what another culture was like. And it happened bit by bit. I didn't start off by writing Ancient Evenings. I was going to write an historical novel that would go through many periods. Each chapter would be about a different era, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Middle Ages, so forth. Too ambitious a novel. I didn't have the culture to begin to write it without spending 20 years in research. So I never got out of Egypt. I started Egypt and thought that would be a chapter. And as I say, I never got out of it. It took 11 years. And I learned a lot about ancient Egypt in the course of 11 years.
I'm sure.
And I found it fascinating because in a way it enabled me to understand the rich. Because in Egypt, it was very, very important to have a proper funeral, which meant everything, the amulets, the talismans, the prayers, the food that was left in the tomb for the dead man, all of that. Because what happens when you died, you wander down into the land of the dead. And in that land of the dead, if you could pass through the land of the dead successfully, then you reach the blessed fields and you live forever. But if you didn't pass through the land of the dead, which was filled with dragons and lakes of flaming oil, and people full of treachery, in other words, you were passing through hell in the land of the dead. If you didn't make it and you were killed in the land of the dead, then you died a second time and that was it. And there were prayers the Egyptians had of, oh, they prayed to one or another god, and they said, do not let me die in the land of a second death in the land of the dead.
How did you research this?
Well, there were a good many good books about it in English. E.A. Wallace Budge and books translated from the French and the German. And I just spent, a lot of it was tough reading, and I just spent years reading this stuff and absorbing it as I went from panel to panel in the book. It's a book that moves through panels. In other words, there's a mythology at the beginning of the book that some people love and some people find very difficult. And then you go on from that into the young man who's telling the story, who's 6 years old, but an extraordinary six-year-old, tells the story for a while. They're all telepathic in the book. It's a very complex novel full of startling elements.
Did you go to Egypt?
Yeah, but that I left in a hurry after being there about a week. I thought, if I hang around here, I'll never write the book. Because what had happened is Egypt had gone, was after the war with Israel in 74. And Egypt, the population of Cairo had increased from 2 million to something like 6 million in 1 year. The town was teeming. Everything was awful, as it would be in a city that's grown that quickly. And as a result, I just felt there's no trace of ancient Egypt here. This is all being trampled under by hordes. Let me get out of here or I won't write the novel. And I did that. Never went back. Didn't have to, you know. You're better off when your imagination is doing the traveling for you.
Let's totally reverse polarity. If you, Norman Mailer, could call back any of your works and either revise or simply cancel it out.
I wouldn't cancel out any of them.
Not any.
Having children. I say, no, yeah. Let's execute that child. Forget it.
Would you revise any of them?
No, probably not. I think the record of what you're doing, it's not that they're that perfect that they can't be revised, but I think it's a mistake. I think it's better to move on. because what you do is you blur the historical authenticity of any particular book by revising it. I revised, by the way, a little bit for the time of our time, because I'd go through something and find that there was dead wood in it. And since these were all short pieces of excerpts, I'd sometimes combine it with something else I'd written. So, for example, in The Superman Goes to the Supermarket, which is about
yes.
Kennedy's 1960 convention in Los Angeles, parts of it, as I remembered it, was terrific, but when I read it, not all of it was terrific. Some of it was dead wood. So I cut out the dead wood and put in excerpts from Harlot's Ghost, which had a airline stewardess who was having an affair with Kennedy, who was present at the convention in 1960. And I interlarded sections from that book with the piece on Kennedy. So in a certain sense, for people who know my work, in fact, maybe even more for people who know my work, there are now some startling montages. I mean, in other words, I put the book together like a movie, where what I wanted to end up being was a social and cultural history of America as one man saw it, myself.
Well, now that you have published this, I will say it, you're too modest. I feel is a magnificent career retrospective volume, The Time of Our Time. Do you feel that your work is essentially complete or nearly complete, or do you have major projects yet to go?
Well, I hope it's not that late. At 75, you just can't start making predictions on how much you're going to do. But there's one book I absolutely want to write, and that's the second volume of Harlot's Ghost. I made the promise 7 years ago to be continued.
I know a lot of people have wondered about that.
Well, I've done 4 other books in the meantime, but I've kept waiting for some kind of idea of how to go on with it. But don't forget, the CIA has changed completely since 91. By 91, the end of the Cold War came, and suddenly the CIA, which had been enormously important and one of the spectral elements in our assessment of America, has suddenly became an ordinary bureaucratic organization in the mind of most Americans. Now they're flaring up again because we didn't get that news about India.
Yes, indeed.
But generally speaking, there's been very little interest in the CIA for years now. And so I didn't know how to do it because the second volume had to be at least as good as the first volume of Where Were We? So for that reason, I couldn't figure out a way to do it, but I think I found a way now. I'm not going to talk about it, of course, but let's see. But maybe I can get going on it in the next couple of months.
I wish to thank you again, Norman Mailer, for coming in the studio today. It's been a wonderful, widely ranging interview. I've enjoyed it immensely, and I'm sure our readers will as well. And I'm sure they will enjoy The Time of Our Time by Norman Mailer.
Well, Dick, you really know how to run a horse around the track.
Thank you.